Hello all, and welcome to another episode of Fueled by Charcoal, a podcast where artists speak openly about burnout, inspiration, and their creative process. I'm your host, Connor Saffron, jack of all trades, master of some, and today I'm joined by Tim Shiner. How would you define yourself as a creative?
I'm a creative that has gone over a lot of different arts, and I really don't have a home art, but I do a little bit of everything.
Many jacks, many trades.
Like you said, master of none. No, I do a little bit of everything. Some sketching, some painting. Used to be an actor. Worked behind the scenes for film companies. Did some writing. Still do some writing. Actually do a lot more writing now. And anything that sparks my creative outlet, I just jump into.
Definitely. And before we shift focus to the primary question of Fueled by Charcoal, which is, you know, burnout, creative blocks, the process, just to give like a brief history, like what are your favorite projects across the mediums that you've engaged with?
Some films that I've worked on and worked with, which several I am not credited on, but that's okay. I've got to work with an amazing executive producer, John Daly, who he made a lot of people a lot of money and a lot of other people very poor. I learned a lot from him. People either loved him or hated him. He was quite a divisive character in the film business. But I got to call him friend, which was really amazing. So he was an executive producer on movies like Terminator, Lost Emperor, or Last Emperor, Falcon and the Snowman, quite a few. I got to know him later in life, where he directed, wrote and directed The Aryan Couple, starring Martin Landau.
Wow.
Who was another member of our crew at the office there. He had an office with us. So I've known him, for quite a while. Unfortunately, both of them are passed. Mm-hmm. So I got to call Martin Landau as a friend as well, and we got to talk about acting and discuss the creative process, which he was a method actor. I was not. I was more of a Stanislavski, and he was the true method and really feeling everything. And we just did not agree on things, but he was the Oscar winner, and I am not. So there's that. A real Hollywood legend who was a true gentleman. You don't find that quite often, but some of those film things I was really quite proud of was working with The Aryan Couple, worked with John and Martin. Yeah, that's probably one of my most favorites. One or two that I've produced as well, which are fun. I got onto one of the last movies as a producer because I was able to finish the film. So it was kind of a fix this where you can. Okay, I took it over and almost like a film doctor, as you could say. Worked with a great editor and we hit everything so it was PG-13 and could distribute it. And it was a small one called Moon Pie. Not a lot of people saw it. That's okay. A little weird, a little off kilter, but it was pretty decent.
You mentioned that you were not a method actor. What would you say is your creative process on both sides of the camera, behind the scenes and on screen or on stage?
On stage, that was interesting. I studied the Stanislavski technique, which mm-hmm. is actually actor beats and finding which you actually... There's unique bits about method. So the method by Stanislavski was that, yes, you did actually do the work. You did, you know, if you were looking for a pair of scissors on set, you actually looked for a pair of scissors. Mm-hmm. You didn't pretend like you were, oh, what's in this drawer? You actually looked for the pair of scissors. Whereas some of the full method, Strasberg, that's him, mm-hmm. the Strasberg method, where he would actually feel the emotions. Whereas Stanislavski said, you do the actions so that you might feel them, but it's not imperative that the actor felt them. It's imperative that the audience understood and felt them. So that's kind of the difference between, I guess, the Stanislavski versus the Strasberg method. Yeah,
definitely partially quote Lynch. You don't have to feel the sadness to display sadness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's it. So And I'm a big proponent. Now, not to say that I haven't tried using the Strasberg method and a few stage plays or some other things that I've done, because I have. Because, you know, you just try to stretch your creative muscle.
Very much a ethereal. If you don't use it, you lose it.
Absolutely.
Would you say that your process really, or how you approached Stanislavski's method, was it something that was built on over time and reiteration, or was it something that came more naturally to you?
I think I had a natural connection with it, but it's based on doing research. It's based on opening up the script and looking at the beats of your character, looking at the beats of the script, finding your intentions and what's going on. So it was all based on research, based on a formula, I guess you could say, that you could break it down and find out what each step was going to be. So, and again, it's almost like that it doesn't matter what mood you're in for the creative process. It matters that you actually just do the creative process. So it's, you know, I actually looked up a couple of quotes for this. one of them was, let's see, here it is, by Natalie Goldberg. She said, "Finally, one just has to shut up, sit down, and write," which basically you just go and do the work. So it's not about getting inspired about the work. It's about doing the work.
Definitely. Especially in encompassing writing, a lot of the advice that I've both received and given and done my best to enact, but we're working on it, is that while you can make the comparison to like a lightning strike for waiting for inspiration to strike, it's you do need to be, especially in a professional setting, more willing to chase that storm. You need to go to where the lightning is. If you wait for it to strike on your roof, you may have a couple months or years between those strikes. If you want to make a living out of that recursion.
Oh, if you want talk about making a living, that's something completely different.
Yes, very professional acting as opposed to passion acting. Two different monsters.
But even writing or anything else. But again, I think I mentioned to you previously about this amazing book called The War of Art.
Yes, that's one that's been recommended a few times.
And I actually just reread it again over this past weekend, and I am getting rid of my resistance, as it were. And he said, resistance is evil, and it is pervasive, and it will trick you and be deceptive. And it will, because, you know, you'll want to, when trying to sit down and write, I have never had a cleaner house, because I'm trying to sit down and write. Oh, no, I got to go do the dishes. Oh, no, I got to throw some laundry. No, then I'll sit down and write.
It's a productive avoidance techniques. It's one of those things. Yes,
and that is resistance. And it's like, no, I got to sit down and actually do the work, which I'm actually doing today, which is really awesome. This is Mondays are my usual day offs. But I'm actually sitting down here in front of my desk, and I've been doing a lot of writing. But you've just got to put in the work. It's not easy, and it's a lot of hard work. Inspiration is great when you get it. Go for it and just keep going. I always keep a pen and a notebook with me wherever I go so I can write stuff down. And I know it's kind of, you know, a Luddite, a little bit of a anti-tech person, which is very unique for me because I believe you know me and I love tech and gadgets and I love to stay on.
And I don't think that the connotation with Luddite, while, you know, we can jokingly refer to ourselves as Luddite when we go back to the physical media, I think that having that tangible physical object in front of you is another way to just recommit to engaging with the process of actually writing. We've definitely kind of naturally transitioned into writing. In terms of your writing career, what are some highlights, favorite projects, moments?
I've written for a couple of different magazines, some online outlets, did a short film, added some things in here and there for different films throughout my film career. Again, not credited on the IMDb, but that's okay. I was well compensated on the back end. But some of the most fun is probably doing a couple of humorous articles for a now unfortunately defunct magazine called Moving Pictures, where we kind of make fun of the Hollywood system. So yeah, that's probably one of my favorite writing pieces.
Definitely.
But and again, that was kind of inspired by the Hollywood system, which is just I would call that resistance. It's quite evil as well. I still love it. There's still a lot of great stuff going on.
There's so much conflict. Both you and I are LA adjacent natives, Hollywood adjacent natives. We have spent a lot of time in and on both sides of a soundstage, either just because we're doing the physical setup of an event work or actually working on that soundstage as an employee.
Yep.
And I think that just the proximity gives us so much more insight into just the truly, truly gritty nature of the beast, that it's that lovable, hateable Saturday morning recurring cartoon villain where
it is
so much of this has gone unchanged for over 100 years at this point. And at the same time, it's evolving every day.
Yeah, it's, you know, yeah, it's a love-hate relationship with Hollywood and the Hollywood system. Los Angeles is a movie picture industry town, entertainment town. So nearly every business here is somehow connected with it. And because of that, everybody has a unique perspective on it. Now, it's also a little bit of my anarchy that I love kind of watching it all kind of burnt down now, especially after COVID, and how you don't necessarily need to be in Los Angeles anymore to actually be creative or get creative stuff done.
There definitely are a lot more remote opportunities. The industry definitely wants you, if you can, to be, you know, in close proximity. But I feel that post-pandemic, we had to look at remote work as a more viable means to continue production. Hollywood definitely suffered from that. And it wasn't even just a matter of output. It's just the quality of output, the content of what you're looking at. You could, even if you don't look at a film's release date or its release window, you could definitely tell when a production went through the COVID hell of trying to maintain physical distance, somehow finding a way to either implement a diegetic means to bring masks around or to remove them. It's
like so War wild. Of the Worlds.
Oh gosh, that I can't believe they released that, honestly, in the state that it came in. But
I have not seen it. I've heard. I cannot.
I've only seen to watch it. I've only seen clips of it, and oh my gosh, what an advertisement for Amazon. But that is a whole different can of worms.
Yeah, speaking quality, it's quality is now gone, because that's a good thing and a bad thing. The quality in Hollywood, it shows that it doesn't take a lot of money to do quality work, because there is a lot of great quality work coming on smaller venues like I'll say Amazon or Netflix, or here's a twist, YouTube or any other new social media, when people, you know, TikTok. I mean, there are some quality entertainment, infotainments, education coming through these different mediums. So new media is exploding.
Definitely. It's something that even over a decade ago it was something that I embraced. I definitely, as the cable network format started to become more segmented and malaligned to their customer base, I definitely embraced a lot more creator content directly, which is how I've spent years engaging with streaming platforms like Twitch on both sides as streamer and as viewer, and really just appreciating a lot of interesting, weird content that would not make it through the traditional production system that you find on YouTube. But in the last 4 or 5 years, that we've definitely see a lot more of that coming through back into traditional production.
Exactly. Well, I mean, because technology has made it so accessible for people with not a lot of money, but some of the things that they are creating now are amazing, and they look like they're big budget Hollywood films. People are doing creative stuff. It's amazing.
I mean, my thoughts on that go back to I think it was a South by Southwest panel with Mark Duplass speaking on, more accurately, to film students in the audience about what it is to, the idea of the cavalry is not coming. The cavalry will never come. So you cannot wait for someone to swoop in and bring the budget and bring your cast and bring production answers when you are waiting to do groundwork. You need to just go out and do groundwork. He mentioned that just engaging in the indie process, going to shoot weekend films, things made on a shoestring budget, how to kind of engage with the retail return policies to get what you need to shoot your production over the weekend and then return anything you can't really afford, you know, scrounging through.
I laugh because I've done that.
Yep. I laugh because I've both done that and I've also been the person who had to try to not take the return, having worked in electronics retail. So watching that conversation, I'm like, oh man, this is so many headaches, but I get it.
Yep. You know what? Doing that is actually where the you know what? I'm going to redirect this podcast right back to your point of going back to the creative aspect. A lot of people say, how can you be creative without money? But that's where creativity really shines. If you take a look at like some of the Russian literature or Chekhov, the Cherry Orchard, they had to get past censors. They had to get past boundaries so that they could get their ideas to their audience. So they had to be very creative in how they wrote things. This is how you get around the creative budget. You create new ways of telling the story. You create, instead of having a set, you have no set. There's just so many different ways you can get around budgets, but also telling stories. So it forces your creativity. But again, you have to go and do it. You can't just say, oh, I wish I had this. You've got to actually put the work in and just jump in with both feet.
Definitely. Adversity is both a means of suppressing creativity, but it also embraces and can fuel creativity, assuredly.
Oh, you know, it's not even a hurdle. If one must look at hurdles as a positive exercise. You want to throw this in front of me? All right, let's see how we can get around it, over it, under it, around any way you can get beyond it. So it is actually a creative exercise in itself, and you should actually look forward to these hurdles because it'll make you better. It'll make you more engaged with what you're creating.
It's like the old retail diatribe about how you want to appoint the lazy person to solve your problems because they will find the quickest and least expensive way to do it.
Yep, the easiest way to do it. But yeah, I mean, you have to look for hurdles to overcome. That, I think that's probably the key aspect of creativity. If you're not looking for those hurdles, or if you are stymied by them and you're like driven back, you need to do some more work because you have to look forward to them.
It is one of those kind of very heavy truths that you don't want to hear in the moment. When it comes to being fueled by charcoal, being fueled by that internal burnout, using it to push your creative spark into a fire that burns brighter and more efficiently because you've already tempered yourself by prior heat.
Well, there you go. The first one was you had to make charcoal in order to burn a better
bonfire.
Yeah. So you had to make that first, but how did you have to do that? So you've got to go through the process to do that. And that's what hurdles and boundaries are. So when people say, oh, we can't do the cancel culture, this or that, we can get around that by just being a little more intelligent about it, by being a little more creative. So you can say whatever you want. Yes, there are, as we're seeing, there are some consequences, but just be creative in how you want to say whatever you want to say.
I think that like this conversation is something that we've reiterated because when we first met in a shelter of adversity, we can call it, not to out ourselves, but we were both in a definitely a space that did not encourage creative thinking, and we found a kind of camaraderie in noticing that, oh hey, we are both literate and think about how to solve problems instead of just dancing in front of them.
Exactly.
And so we're kind of starting at the end, but I do want to mention that when it came to my own burnout, just, you know, from being kind of raked over the coals of a very creatively stymied part of my life. I was working 40-hour weeks in retail sales. I had external stressors from all sides and suddenly didn't. And I kind of lost where I was because I had thrown everything that I had attributed as part of myself away to just get the bills paid, get the job done, make sure that I hit my numbers. And finally being broken of that, I didn't really have, you know, the compass or direction or heading or much of anything, just kind of a bit of wood left to float my way on. But we came into a place that was somewhat adverse to creative thinking, but it was also an opportunity to kind of engage in more creative yes. background
absolutely
activities and projects, because ultimately that particular job is not super in-depth or engaging 9 out of 10 hours. So really just the opportunity that doing nothing of value presents, it's one of those counterintuitive amazing things. And I was in the process of like trying to claw my way back. And I think one of the first major reapproaches to writing was we were having a conversation about Taco Bell Quarterly, which
yes.
I was so taken aback by the fact that that was a literary journal that existed. When you presented how open their application process was and just literally anything, even a passing mention of Taco Bell, anything, write anything for it. And you challenged yeah. me to that in awesome. A time and space that I was not seeking out challenges. I was just kind of sitting in the malaise of not having that internal well, spark working.
I think because I was working on a story for it, which unfortunately did not get picked up. Neither of ours.
Neither did mine. Yes, Taco Bell Quarterly, infamous for their response times and selection processes.
Mine was over a year. Yeah, I had mine in over a year. But yeah, so I'm glad that challenged you, because I think you needed a spark but you also need some downtime.
Yeah.
Like the desert that you were in, I was in there too. I was like, okay, done. Over it all. But I needed to look up some new stuff. But we, as creatives, forget that sometimes we just need to be bored. Sometimes we need to be quiet. Sometimes we need to have nothing going on to refresh ourselves.
And it's one of those things that I think systematically has been kind of, we have kind of eroded our willingness to engage in nothing. And that kind of sounds like, you know, sit in a room and do nothing and watch paint dry. But no, it's just like having the opportunity to decompress so that your brain and your creative spirit can just kind of breathe and, you know, gain that second wind. I was definitely in a state where I was kind of denied that opportunity. And I was just exhausted. I had just enough nothing to do that I kind of found a little bit of that healing process to be in the right place and time to hear and accept the challenge to create something for that submission when I wasn't aware. Like, I had never submitted anything to a literary journal that I didn't already, you know, there wasn't an established connection mm-hmm. to. While, you know, that got rejected, the frenetic pace at which I spent the rest of that night writing was so enthralling that it was one of those moments where I found that ember was still burning and really kind of appreciated it. And I've told this story before, but that alongside around the same time is when I had reengaged with the collaborative narrative process that is playing a long-form D&D game and being able to work in a collaborative space where you are working with people who you can really engage with and choose what conflicts between the character arc that you are writing and the synchronicity between the character arcs of your group and the underlying story of whatever campaign is being told. That presented in such a way that, you know, it is a series of challenges to overcome. You're using dice to determine the efficacy of your quick thinking, of your reactivity and response. That was it. Ultimately, yeah, it was re-engaging with challenge after shying away from any kind of effort expenditure for such a long time. And we are kind of working backwards in this, but you mentioned that you too have gone through periods of burnout or creative block.
Oh. So yeah, so it's been somebody, you know, after I kind of I guess retired from the entertainment business for a while, I tried different jobs, doing this, doing that, didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, and being above the age of 50, people are like, what are you doing now, Tim? I'm like, well, I still haven't decided what I want to be when I grow up. So I am actually, I got a call from a longtime friend that I haven't spoken to in many years. And he's like, what are you doing now? And I said, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. That's not quite true, because I know what I want to do right now. I have a business that I'm going to be starting very shortly, working on the business plan right now. But there was times when years that I got nothing done creatively. I felt that it was just, there was nothing going on. I kind of dropped out of society, basically. And I was okay with that.
And not even in the fun Emersonian way where you can commit to work by just living in the woods for a bit.
No, I would love to be in the woods. But no, it was just like, okay, just doing the daily stuff and just kind of, I was basically an NPC for a while.
I think we all have our time. Well, at least the current socioeconomic dichotomy where if you aren't born with more money than you can really ever spend, you kind of just have to put your nose to the grindstone and you're going to be living to pay bills because that's how you keep living. And
well, yeah, but I think my part was a little bit different because from the youngest age, I knew I had always wanted to be an actor. And it wasn't until actually I moved to Los Angeles that I did not want to be an actor. I wanted to be behind the camera and doing the deals and working as a marketing and operations for company that I really got to really enjoy the whole business part of it. So for most of my life, I had always known what I wanted to do. And because of that, I did it and I enjoyed it. And I think after all of that went away, after John Daly had passed away, the company had kind of gone away because there's nobody there to take it over.
Yeah.
And there was really nothing there for me to look forward to. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I allowed, that was good though. That was really good because I think that gave me a lot of time to reflect on myself, on where I wanted to go. And eventually I found that I wanted to go back to school, get my degree, which I did online during COVID, which was crazy and fortuitous at that time, I guess.
It was definitely an opportune time to return right. to school. I wish I had started slightly earlier, but
speaking of the whole boredom thing, and I did, I was like, yeah, I had to look up because I had remembered someone had said something about boredom and creativity. And I think it was Steve Jobs, where Steve Jobs says, "I'm a big believer in boredom. Boredom allows one to indulge in curiosity, and out of curiosity comes everything." And I really, really believe that because you do need to allow yourself to do that. Granted, I took way too many years off. I think that was all my 40s, but that's okay. But I sort of started to come back in my 50s. I went back for the school, got the degree in English and history, and I eventually found what I wanted to do, create, and really, really go forward with it. And it's not about money. And a lot of people say, oh, it's about money. No, you create because it's what you have to do.
Yeah, that's one thing that I have been quoted and requoted, and I don't even know the source of, or if there is a singular source, but when you engage with a creative medium in a professional setting, that you are there not because you are trying to make a lot of money, because you will not make a lot of money. You are not there because you are going to be the next Stephen King for those in the writing sector, because that's a bar. You might be, but you're not going to be there from the outset. You engage with creativity because you literally cannot see yourself doing anything else. You have to do this. That is why you yes. commit to it.
Yep. And I've done a couple of panels and stuff when I was an actor. You wouldn't have seen me in anything. I did mostly stage acting. So I've done panels and questions and answers, and people go, I want to be an actor. I said, you don't want to be an actor if there's anything else you can do and be happy. Yeah. At that time in my life, it was great. I did Midwest tour stuff. I had friends who are on Broadway who are Martin Landau, some really great people that I know. They've won Tony Awards, amazing people. I wouldn't change my life because I really loved what I did. But no, you've got to love what you're doing. If you don't, then you're just living as an NPC, basically.
Yeah.
And what's the point? It doesn't make sense.
That is the end goal, is to look back upon life lived even in the worst of times and not want to change even a minute of it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, do I want to? Yeah, I could have made some other choices, some better choices along the way. But I wouldn't have the stories. I wouldn't have the experiences that I have.
Oh, yeah. That is ultimately why I think it should be a social requirement that we all do our 9 layers of retail inferno trekking. Because
that and
for the stories alone, yeah, any service job, I think that really it should be, there should be a mandatory conscription from the ages of 20 to 22, where if you are working at all, you have to work a customer service or retail job, because if not, if for no other reason than the stories that you'll have.
You know what? Having done that, I also really make sure that people understand the full quote of "the customer is always right," which, as we know, is not "the customer is always right" in matters of taste. Yeah, the customer is not always right. Absolutely not.
No, the customer is usually wrong.
Yeah.
But we've definitely had that.
You and I have definitely had that conversation before. Absolutely.
So in your time of, I guess, kind of a quiet healing, even if it wasn't really something that you were intending to do with that time off, but in your time away from your creative focus, were there any practices that you had begun to adopt to try to be more proactive about reengaging with your creative side? What was that inciting incident?
Actually, you know what? There actually was, and it was quite recently, very quite recently. I had been given a book called The Vein of Gold by Julia Cameron. Mm. She's also the author of The Artist's Way, which I think you've heard of, and almost everyone has heard of it.
Still on my to-read list.
It is, I would really highly suggest that, or The Vein of Gold. Now, my friend bought me this one in Chicago when I was back there doing theater and being creative, and I never really got into it. I started to read a couple of pages, and I started it then, and then I didn't really continue with it. I don't know why, but I came across it in stacks of books. I just got so many damn books. But I came across this, let me reread this, and started to do it, and it had in there the morning pages, where you get up, the first thing you do in the morning is write 3 pages by hand, and it's just kind of like a brain dump to get you going. And I have been doing that for probably a little over a year now, and so that was the inciting incident, and it has really truly helped me get creative. Honestly, I would say that by doing that, that actually inspired my business coming up. It inspired me taking new steps, learning some new stuff, taking online classes for HTML. I don't know why I started taking those, just because I was interested. I built my own home server, so technology stuff. I don't know why, but I would probably say that writing every morning 3 pages by hand got rid of a lot of the day-to-day stuff. You know, you wake up with stuff and you're like, and it's not creating a to-do list. It's just your stream of consciousness. Oh, I don't want to do this. My arm hurts. I need to go through physical therapy for my shoulder, or God, I'm gassy today. You know, whatever comes to your head, you just write that down.
Yeah, it was a practice that you've definitely suggested in the past, and it's one that I want to try to read. There is no try. I am going to try to commit to more consistently in the future, because I've heard this advice from many sources. However, the one that comes to mind is from Jerry Seinfeld, regardless of how people feel about him, you know, outside of his comedy and his social choices. Seinfeld did commit to a daily writing practice when it came to jokes, because he always wrote at least one joke. He would, in the morning, wake up and write down a joke and would not leave that journal until there was a joke in it every single day. And I think that there's the, you know, the ideals of like commitment to a pattern, making a ritual part of your daily must-dos, creating that flow. There's a scientific reinforcement in creating neural pathways and utilizing neural elasticity to just keep that creative process built into your brain, making that circuit active and constant.
Interestingly, you brought up the ritual, because that's part of the war of art. Stephen, I can't remember his last name. Part of the ritual of his was that when you sit down to write, you invoke the muse. Mm. And he writes every morning. He gets up, he has his coffee, reads the newspaper, then he goes in, sits and does his work. And again, here's another great quote from Pearl Buck, who says, "I don't wait for moods. You accomplish nothing if you do that. Your mind must know it has got to get down to work." So if you create that process by which you sit down and work at your desk, or your creative aspect, it does create those neural pathways in your head. It creates the expectation that you will be creative and thus follows it. And that's, again, here's part of my Stanislavski acting technique, is if you actually do the movement and look for stuff, you're actually looking for the stuff. You become that embodiment of that emotion. You don't artificially feel it.
It is a commitment to the practice in the less often used term for practice, more so like a doctor's practice than it is, I'm going to try to do this every day. It is a greater degree of commitment. It is, and that commitment becomes a part of you. It becomes more internalized the more you commit to it. And I understand and respect it. I just wish I could embody that practically. I'm going to get there.
It takes a lot of effort, but it's effort really worth doing. I did not want to do my warning pages this morning when I woke up. I was just like, oh, I don't want to do them. But I did them. And my handwriting was awful for the first 2.5 pages. Then the last couple of sentences, I'm like, okay, I've got to finish this strong. Take my time, really make my handwriting legible. Come on. I pushed myself. It got great, because then when I finished that, then I opened up my word processor and started writing till I got a text from you.
That's me committing to my practice, because I had to get up today and I had to get this done because I'm running against a clock.
But that's kind of good as well, because sometimes you need that clock. You've got boundaries and you have to look at that and say, hey, this is a hurdle. Get excited by it.
Setting deadlines for myself is something that I definitely have committed more frequently to, because I need to. I'm with the return to school and an expedited monthly class-based program. It's not a matter of if I feel like doing this week. I don't care if I don't feel like doing this. I have to get it done, and I have to get it done 3 hours sooner because the school's on the East Coast.
Right, and that should be part of the creative process as well. Until that is a part of your normal day, the creative process, that's what really needs to happen. That's it. Can you really call yourself a creative?
Well, this is a conversation I've definitely had on this program before, but when it comes to calling oneself a creative, the identity of an artist is something that I feel like is more inherently tied to a style or shape, like an ethereal shape, not necessarily one defined by dimension, but just how you perceive, how you choose to perceive. Creative thinkers don't necessarily need to commit to a particular productivity to call themselves artists. It's definitely easier to look to a body of work, but I think that artists exist everywhere. Creatives exist across the entirety of the spectrum. Anyone who gets a job done, I think, has to engage with their creativity to a degree.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You've got to be creative in, well, every aspect of life. You should be creative. I believe it was Henry Ford had when someone came in, they were going to make his company a little bit more streamlined, and somebody was sitting on a desk with their feet up, and they said, what's he doing? He's costing you $40,000 a year just sitting there. You should get rid of him. He says, ah, yeah, but that $40,000 a year, he came up with an idea for me 2 years ago that netted me $2.8 million.
I think that definitely when it comes to where we find ourselves burning out, where we find ourselves at that kind of whole body response to exhaustion, from both mental and physical standpoints, is really just the reciprocation of effort to product. And as creatives, we tie that to whatever project we might be working on, whatever our medium is. But I kind of relate this back to what really got me into the dumps was a line of thinking that I've been trying to step past, but when working retail in the last 3 years of working that particular job, I had to become very aware of my numbers. That was something that was always an issue because it was a very competitive and sales-oriented space. But when you look at the end of the year numbers and you get to just toggle that Excel sheet from monthly to annual, and you see that by your efforts alone, you have netted the company 7 figures, and you are barely taking 5 home. It weighs on, well, when is this worth it? Is there, initially, there was definitely a bit of self-satisfaction, less so actualization, you know, understanding that here is a tangible proof of a skill set. I think that focusing on that tangible proof is something that is really destructive to consistency in a creative space, because this thing I made either didn't get approved or selected, or I never got to that finished ending, or I'm looking at it 3 months later and I just, with a scowl of disdain, as it could have been so much better. Definitely, when it comes to facilitating how you turn that charcoal into a fuel source, is not to worry about how much fire comes from this particular piece of wood.
Just exactly.
That it's, you keep on you've burning.
You've got to look at, instead of looking at those numbers and that you're making money for the company, did you enjoy that part? Did you find it rewarding in and out of it itself? You're worried about making so much money for the company. You weren't thinking about the joy of... there is some joy in customer service.
There were phases of perspectives to take where, you know, there was the version of myself that said, I am legitimately helping people, which I think was a little bit of a desperate pull, but it was a point of engagement where people came in and, you know, people don't necessarily do as much research as they can. So they come in knowing not as much as they probably should. And you get to be the person that bridges the gap between what they want and what they need. And then there's the more mischievous side of it where it's, okay, this person doesn't care as to how much or what they're spending their money on. Let's see how much extravagance you can have them engage in. You know, it sounds malicious, but ultimately it was just a matter of...
Yeah, but it could be fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, hey man, like, yeah, you came in here for a $15 pair of headphones, but you know how good these, like, $80 pair of headphones are?
But, I mean, but that's part of creativity, that's part of play, though, as well.
Yeah, there's definitely...
you've got to play.
Retail engages, I think, a similar skill set that... stage actors, not to bridge that particular gap because it is vast, but there is a similar, you know, you definitely have to learn facades and how to apply them. And there's a, you know, a degree of social psychology and internalization that exists between both.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to know your audience. You have to know your director. You have to know the script, and you have to understand and know your motivation. That's why you always hear these actors, oh, what's my motivation? Well, you got to know what the motivation is so you can engage your different tactics of how you're going to go about it. Say your tactic is to, let's say, sell a stereo. Now, you're going to have different people. You might have to try to go over there and be very suave or be very sexy, or you might be very dismissive, like, oh, you can't afford that, which might engage them, say, I can afford this, and make them buy it. Or you might say, hey, this would make you look really good, and they would say, oh, really? Yeah. So you got to use different tactics. So as a retail person, you have to really understand that. So that's what actors do. That's all they do.
And the trump card is just to pull out a vaguely Texan accent, which apparently calms people. There's a weird correlation there.
Well, yes, and it's because the Southern accent unfortunately seems to be viewed as a non-threatening accent, or I don't want to say it, but as a, you know, not as educated or well refined, but it is it's a stereotype, a very misleading one, but it's also a very charming accent. So you're like, oh, okay.
It's a stereotype that should you choose to engage in, you will be spending about 5 times as much as you planned.
Absolutely. I have a friend who actually just moved to Ireland, and she's very American, and she unfortunately loves the Irish accent. And there's some people in Ireland who, yeah, have an Irish accent that you just should not trust. Mm. So it's and that's the same thing. But yeah, if you can pull out a Texas accent to diffuse a situation, absolutely.
So just to re-approach, when you pivoted mediums, was that mm-hmm. something where, was it the lack of that familiarity from your prior work, from your prior workspace and those relationships where you didn't want to attempt to rebuild that particular stack of cards? Or was it engaging in something that you had longed for while prioritizing other creative processes?
Difficult question to answer. I'm not really sure how or why I pivoted. When I moved out to Los Angeles, I was like, you know what? Because I'm not a film actor look. I would definitely be a character actor, and I never saw parts for me. So I just pivoted away from that aspect, but still being creative in the marketing and, very funny, being creative in the operations section of a corporation as well. Mm-hmm. So there was that aspect of being creative. And then it was just kind of like, nothing's going on, just kind of doing nothing. But during that time also, I was engaged in a lot of different creative aspects. One of my home arts, as it were, is also magic. And unfortunately, now, you know, I was going to become a member of the Magic Castle, and there was a magic store on Hollywood Boulevard, and they had a lot of interesting stuff. They're unfortunately long gone now, and that whole art seems to be slowly disappearing. But as a child, I grew up with that. It was amazing, and I loved it. It was never really, let's go do a magic act, I meet girls, but that's, you know, it was interesting. But that was my home art, my first art that I started to as a child. And I just kind of continued that for a very long time. I've not really done anything in a while, so I have a bag filled with lots of stuff, and I spent a lot of money on it. And I do sketch, watercolors, I paint. So I continue with the creative aspect because it's something that I have to do.
But so then it's less about dedication to a medium and more about just engaging that facet.
Yeah, there has to be some form of creativity. And I think for those 10 years where I was kind of like testing different waters, I guess, maybe. And I wasn't as productive creatively or committed. So I kind of, that was my burnout. That was my lull, a very long lull. But I'm glad I did that because I really have fallen in love with the English language and words. But you would think I would appreciate as a former actor, but it didn't hit me as much as novels do now, or essays, or short stories.
Well, I think the appreciation of like linguistics and the art of the double or more entendre definitely comes more when studying linguistics. One of the first conversations that we had when both interviewing for the jobs that we are currently maintaining for the sake of their benefits, one of those initial conversations was engagement with language. And do you think that kind of targeted appreciation and adaptation of increasing your range of communication reciprocated your creative focus at all?
Not with our current job, but I think maybe that's why both of us caught a lot of things.
Well, like, more so in that when you were studying, politically correct term now is just modern Irish, right, as opposed to Gaelic?
Yeah. yes.
You were studying modern Irish, and I was studying Japanese, and that was one of those first conversations that we had. I think it was just a note of I had a kanji notebook or something in my bag, and you commented on it, and we got to talking about studying language communications. And I think that it is a facet of artistic engagement to try to communicate some message regardless of your medium. You put intent into whatever your piece or project is, and you hope that your audience of choice either engages with the message you intend or with whatever they may impart of their own volition. Do you think that engaging with broadening your communicative horizons may have reignited that creative spark?
Absolutely. Because, and again, like starting with acting, where you actually do your research and find out what what the beats are, what the rhythm of the scene. You do that with literature as well. You really reach into it, and because there are hidden things within literature that people may not initially be aware of, and there are mysteries within literature. There are I had read an amazing journal essay about Edgar Allan Poe and the fall of the House of Usher, where Poe describes the house. And if you look at the house, the author of the journal essay wrote that if you look at the house and what he was describing, you look into the souls of the house by looking through the windows. And he was describing the entire house as the body of a human. It was the head of the human, and it was cracking. It was falling apart. And that was their entire family. But it was so subtle within there that it just, you go, oh my God, how did I miss that after all of these years? And you go back to it, and you're like, oh my God. So now you got to go back and look at everything else you read as a young person, as an older person. You just got to really look in.
That was definitely something I've been contending with recently, is trying to prioritize going back and re-reading or re-listening to or re-watching particular media, just because I am a significantly different person than I was at a young age when I was watching Evangelion way, way too soon, way too young for that. Didn't appreciate any of the religious aspects of the core of that particular show. But also just going back and just engaging with, because I am a different person than I was even 7 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but also that deep-seated desire to try to chip away at all of those books I'll never read before I die. and, you know, finding something, as an appreciator of B-movies, of finding, you know, inspiration in stories not told particularly well, so that I might, you know, be able to take inspiration and find some way to fix what is broken or reshape something to be more effective. But do you think that you've hit a state of sustained rituals or support structures or mantras that you believe that you are engaging with your creativity in a healthy way so that you don't reach that old state of burnout?
I'm going to say no. Mm. But that's only simply because I'm just really, really re-engaging with it all. And I am thoroughly enjoying it. And I think you and I have talked about this previously, about how much I'm actually really enjoying this new renaissance of creativity with myself.
Yeah.
About really, you know, and this may come with age as well. I'm not giving a fuck, really. I mean, I just don't care what people think about me. This is what I'm doing. I am creating something new. I'm writing. I am doing stuff. And, you know, I'm being weird. I don't care.
Yeah, context of what the younger kids would say, we are cringe, but we are free.
Exactly. I saw something on YouTube Short said, you know, buy the weird stuff, make people really wonder about you at your estate sale. And I love that. That's great.
I think the way I've heard that is, you know, have enough money that you can buy the old Victorian on the edge of town and make the townspeople talk about you when you're not around.
Yes, that too. But also, you know, if you're having an estate sale, it doesn't matter where you live, just have really weird stuff.
Yeah.
And enjoy it, you know?
I think there was a recent article or interview with, I'm pretty sure it was Yoko Taro, creator of the Nier series and Drakengard, who just stated outright that he is concerned for the state of the games industry primarily, but I think for it applies to all creative media, where he stated that there aren't enough weirdos making things anymore.
Yes, and I agree.
And some of, like, the leading, you know, media within that medium, for sure, are just the byproducts of a really just dedicated to your vision kind of auteur. Thinking of developers like Hideo Kojima, whole can of worms. I could talk about the man. I appreciate it and his work. Like, reads over 300 books a year while also doing everything else he does.
That's another thing that I think we might have spoken about, you know, you get, the busier you get, the more you get done.
Yeah.
And I really agree with that. So I like to try to stay as busy as possible, or I try to anyway. It doesn't always work, but yeah, you get actually get stuff done when you are busy. The more you get to, it's just weird, but weird, stay weird. That's I like that saying as well. Stay weird.
We all just have approved citizenship in Portland just because we embrace the town.
Yeah. Isn't that an Austin as well?
Keep Austin weird is, I think, their dichotomy, which is a little more aggressive, which fits because it's Texas.
And I think you had mentioned a quote about be the weird you want to see.
Yeah, be the weird you want to see in the world. I don't remember where I first saw that, but it's a saying that I've seen. And
I like it, and I'm embracing it, so yeah.
So, looking back, and again, looking back is pointless, but...
No, it doesn't. You're saying that I got a degree in English and history. History!
Grand scale, but looking to your personal history... If you could coin one phrase or piece of advice to a past self that you would want to implement sooner, what do you think that would be?
Keep going. You're doing great, because I think we mentioned before, there's not, you know, would I make different choices? Maybe. But no, I wouldn't. I don't think I would give myself, looking back for myself, I wouldn't give myself any other advice. Because I look back, and I do look back actually quite a bit. I'm like, would I change anything? And no, I wouldn't, because then I wouldn't know the people that I know now. And the people that I know now that I cherish as friends are extremely dear to me. I consider them family. Mm. I don't have a lot of them, but I have some. The ones that I have are very dear to me, and I would do anything for. They embrace the weird. They engage in creative aspects. And if I gave myself advice, I wouldn't have these people in my life, because I would have made other choices. I would have gone down a different path. And to do that would negate any of the people that I currently have around me. And I really honestly cherish everybody around me.
So definitely just embracing the good and the bad, because the journey is the journey and the destination is still up ahead, but where you're going is the path you took.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, I guess that's the best way to put it. It's about the journey. It really is. Do you want to create something and do something really great? Everybody wants to do that. Nobody's unique in that aspect. They want to create something amazing, great. Just keep going. Keep moving. That's the only thing. It's just keep moving. Keep going forward. And I don't even want to say don't have a depression. Don't be bored. I don't want to say that, because you need it all. Those are all hurdles and things that need to happen. You need to overcome them.
So
you
face look the challenge at them as, head on.
You have to. That's, you know, look at them as opportunities for creativity. No, there's nothing I would not to say that my life was perfect. It was not. It was like, but it was interesting. I had a lot of fun.
And at the end of the day, that's really the best of what we can ask for.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a pretty charmed life. I loved it. I still love it. So who knows what's going next? Like I said, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up, and I'm okay with that.
I think growing up is a subscription-based thing. It's a scam by big A to sell us on timeshares.
No timeshares. Yeah, no, I'm not. I'm a big proponent of actually not growing up. There's no point in it.
Yeah, I think definitely while it is the term has re-entered the cancerous internet lexicon of the now, keeping and maintaining your whimsy is so crucial.
Yeah, and learning how to play. I mean, even as an adult, adults need to learn how to play.
That was probably the most successful hook for the program that I'm working now, because one of the first classes I took was the psychology of play, which really just kind of emphasized, hey, schedule some time for you to do whatever the hell it is you need to do. Get your responsibilities set. But you need to prioritize engaging in recreation and in your creative output to the same degree of importance that everything else maintains. This is just as important as going to the bank and doing whatever you have to do this week. This is just as important as making sure your laundry is done. This is just as important. And I think that really kind of shattered a kind of glass ceiling that I had placed above myself.
Awesome. Because, I mean, if you look at people who we either work with or out and about in the world who don't do that, they're boring and old and crotchety as all fuck. And I'm sorry, those people learn to have fun. Oh, my God.
If you're going to be a grumpy old man and or woman and or non-binary elderly geriatric person, you got to have fun with it a little bit. Shake your cane at the neighborhood kids, but, you know, also put out something for Halloween that'll scare the shit out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Turn the sprinklers on them or something. I mean, but you got to, you know, be the fun old person at the end. Don't be the crotchety one.
Or at least have fun being the crotchety old person.
Exactly. Grumpy old men. Awesome.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you again for coming on today, for sharing your perspective and your experience, and really just the undertone of establishing that your response to burnout is challenge. Take it as a challenge, embrace it as a challenge, and face it head on. Absolutely. Is there anything that you're working on now, any projects that you'd like to tell people, where can people find you?
Really good. I had started another written thing that I need to work on. I should work on that today. I had started a daily blog about a cyberpunk robot, discovering that he is sentient slowly. It was a daily blog, and I got about three and a half months with it every day. And then I took a nice long trip to Ireland, and I kind of fell off. So I don't want to give you that one yet. I've got nothing online right now that I want to necessarily push right now. So I don't really have anything available at the moment. I'm working on it. When it's available, I'll push it out.
But, when we see it, we'll retroactively come in and throw some links down in the episode description, assuredly.
Awesome.
But again, perfect. Thank you for coming on. And you, dear viewer, I appreciate you spending your time with us today. And if you found today's discussion meaningful, or you know someone creative who might resonate with this conversation, consider sharing the episode. But until next time, remember, go at your own pace. You'll get there. Keep on keeping on, and keep those home fires burning.
Be weird.
Be weird. It's the only way.